Hello. The contents of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources, and I'm going to start with an article from AARP Magazine. And actually, I read you the first part of this article a few weeks ago, and I'd like to continue with it. This is called The Changing American Table. And we're going to go back to the 60s here. Back in the 60s, a young writer named Nora Ephron took a worried look at the schizophrenic American diet and wondered which way it would go. Whatever happens, she wrote in 1968, the food establishment at this moment has the power to change the way the Americans eat. And, in fact, about all it is doing is showing how to make a prettier pie crust and fill a better bread box. She had a point. Those in the food press were so busy discovering new cuisines, so involved with recipe writing and restaurant reviews, that they paid scant attention to what was really happening to our food. It wasn't good. Nixon's Secretary of Agriculture, Earl Butz, was determined to make food even cheaper for Americans. It was the Cold War on steroids, as he urged farmers to get big or get out. The result was the demise of even more small farms and the rise of even larger and more efficient factory farms. These allowances all came at a cost, including to flavor. One day in the 70s, I boarded a plane while carrying a flat of heirloom strawberries from a small California farmer. The effect was electric. The perfume of those aromatic berries filled the plane, and one by one, people rose from their seats to beg for a taste. "Oh," crooned one woman, closing her eyes as a look of ecstasy crossed her face. "I had forgotten what strawberries used to taste like." We had all forgotten. Yes, the strawberries, corn, tomatoes, and peaches in our supermarkets were big. They were beautiful. They lasted a long time, too. The meats were plentiful. It's just that none of it tasted like much anymore. Some people also began to wonder if the new foods were as nutritious as they once had been. And what about those animals that were being raised in cages? In 1971, Francis Moore LaPaye published Diet for a Small Planet, which proved to be a wake-up call for millions of young people, including me. Pointing out that raising meat is an extremely inefficient way to produce calories, she urged her readers to get their protein by combining grains and legumes. We were all very earnest, and as Anna Thomas's The Vegetarian Epicure appeared, followed by Molly Katzen's Moosewood Cookbook and William Sherfflett's and Akiko Ayaki's The Book of Tofu, a lot of us started down the road to vegetarianism. You might call the 70s the granola decade. Farmers' markets opened, soda bottles began to be recycled, and counterculture foods such as Celestial Seasonings, herbal teas, and Yoplait yogurt appeared on our supermarket shelves, and Ben and Jerry's opened their first store. Then the food scares started. In the 80s, when I became the food editor of the Los Angeles Times, the newspaper's lawyers insisted we put warnings on all recipes featuring undercooked or raw eggs. The American egg supply was so badly contaminated by salmonella that we even advised our readers to avoid soft-boiled eggs. The terms salmonella, botulism, and mad cow disease entered our vocabulary. We were accustomed to being cautious about what we ate when we went abroad, but few people of my generation had ever worried about the safety of American food. It was a shock, though temporary. In 1993, Reese Schoenfeld had an idea to change the way we thought about food, a television channel devoted exclusively to what we eat. TV's Food Network started on a shoestring budget, but within 15 years had become a juggernaut, that changed America's ideas about food and cooking and made chefs the coolest people on the planet. Viewers wanted to taste new foods, travel to new places, and cook. Cooking, once relevated to the women's pages of newspapers, had finally broken free. I don't think it is possible to overstate the positive influence of food television. It may have begun with silly shows such as the kitschy Japanese Iron Chef and with Emeril Lagasse shouting, "Bam!" but it paved the way for the enormous range of programs that have become part of popular culture. Most important, thoughtful cooks like Anthony Bourdain inspired a generation to look at food in a way Americans never had before. For the first time in our history, we are starting to understand that how and what we eat have consequences far beyond the table. People who care about the environment, for instance, have driven the cause of organic farms, whose numbers have doubled in the past 10 years. Old-time farmers had it right. Plants grown in fertile soil are not only more nutritious, they also require less water. Major companies such as General Mills and Nestle are starting to put millions into regenerative agriculture, and that is cause for rejoicing. But the most revolutionary changes in food production revolve around meat. Research has shown that a meat-based diet increases the risk of heart disease and cancer, and environmentalists worry about the vast amount of water it takes to produce a pound of beef, mostly to grow food for the cattle. Bring on the plant-based burgers. They're everywhere, and meat, egg, and fish alternatives are showing up on menus across the country. Though note, many of those alternatives rely on genetically modified beans and grains, along with a range of unpronounceable chemicals. The coronavirus disrupted the American food supply, and it changed the way I shop, cook, and eat. Seeing packaged plants turned into COVID-19 hotspots made me question how we process our meat. Watching the domino effect of the restaurant shutdowns, dairies having to dump milk, fishermen who lost so much business that they simply docked their boats, has inspired me and many other Americans to spend in ways that could more directly benefit our food suppliers and producers. Indeed, across the country, people in lockdown began to cook again, and the family meal, long threatened, returned in earnest. Many who had never before put their hands into the dirt planted gardens. Seed sales have soared. People like me, who live in rural parts of the country, began buying our food straight from the farm, just like my mother once did. I know I'll be doing that for the rest of my life. And there's another reason to be hopeful. As Nixon told Khrushchev in 1959, the American system is designed to take advantage of new inventions and new techniques. For most of our lifetimes, that technology was used to give us cheaper food. We're finally beginning to understand the hidden costs and far-reaching consequences of those inventions, and there's no reason to believe that new technology will not bring us food that is increasingly healthful, nutritious, and flavorful. If there is anything to be learned from the history of American food, it is that we are capable of enormous changes at the drop of a fork. So, cookbook author and memoirist Ruth Reichel was the restaurant critic for the Los Angeles Times and the New York Times, and was the editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. Her latest memoir is Save Me the Plums, written in 2019. Now, we had a sidebar on this that itemized the inventions in the last years. So let's start back with 1971. Hamburger Helper, magic powders stretch a pound of hamburger. And the crock pot, AM, pop in cheap meat, plus PM, enjoy delightful dinner. In 1972, we have Celestial Seasonings. Four hippies began the herbal tea boom. 1975, Famous Amos, ushered in the 80s gourmet cookie explosion. 1976, California Cooler. This pre-mixed sangria started a trend. 1980, Lean Cuisine. Low-cal frozen entrees sold out that first year. 1989, Electric Juicer. Suddenly fruits and veggies could just be drunk. 2006, Avocado Toast. Blew up when a famed NYC restaurant offered it. 2010, Instant Pot. Multi-cooker that conquered the kitchen. And finally, in 2011, Meal Kits. HelloFresh and others take the decisions out of dinner. Now let's move on to an article from the Special Health Edition of Immunity magazine. The Secret Life of Germs. Beyond coronavirus, a single nanoscopic pathogen can have your entire household laid up in bed or near the bathroom for weeks. Here's how to outsmart the little boogers. And this is by Jancy Dunn and Noel LeBlanc. During the age of COVID-19, it's easy to panic with every cough, sniffle, or aching throat. When it comes to fighting germs beyond coronavirus, knowledge is power. We all know how to wash our hands frequently while singing Happy Birthday twice. So let's dig deeper and tackle the more mystifying question about germs. For instance, how quickly can a germ you picked up at work cause intestinal distress? If someone sneezes in your face, okay, let's get down to it. Influenza virus causes the flu. Can live for an hour or more in the air and up to 9 hours on hard surfaces such as metal desks, counters, and faucets. On porous surfaces like towels, it dies within a few hours. Although if your family uses a communal hand towel in the kitchen, and who doesn't, that's enough to do the job. How it spreads. Through the air. When a person talks, sneezes, or coughs, and bodily contacts such as a handshake. The flu germ typically incubates for 1 to 4 days, with most people starting to feel sick after 2 days. Typical scenario is someone sneezes on the ATM right before you walk in. You use the keypad, then scratch your nose. Boom. Not so fun fact. You can be contagious with the flu a day before symptoms show up, so you might not even know you're sick as you're spreading it around town. Rhinovirus causes the common cold. Can live for up to 24 hours on hard surfaces like plastic and stainless steel. How it spreads. Direct contact with an infected person, often through the hands or breathing in droplets from someone who has just sneezed, talked, or coughed. After being exposed to germs, most people catch a cold within 1 to 3 days. Typical scenario is you're in the crowded waiting area at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and the sniffy, snuffly person standing next to you coughs in your direction. Not so fun fact, there are more than 100 subtypes of rhinovirus, which is why you can recover from one cold and then get another immediately after. Norovirus causes the stomach flu. It can live for, wait for it, up to weeks on hard surfaces, and it can even survive common household disinfectants. It is easily spread in situations where people are in close contact, said Graham Snyder, MD, Medical Director of Infection Prevention at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. For some infections, you need large numbers of the germ to make somebody sick, he says. But for norovirus, you just need a few, so it's easy to transmit. That's why you end up with trouble, for example, on a cruise ship. How it spreads. Touching an infected surface, sharing utensils with infected people, or eating contaminated foods. Symptoms can appear in 12 hours. Typical scenario, you try a bite of your friend's pasta at lunch, and she texts an hour later to tell you she's throwing up. It's coming for you. Not so fun fact, norovirus is a fecal-oral pathogen, meaning microparticles from poo, have somehow made it into your mouth. Kind of gross, I know, says Kelly Reynolds, Ph.D., an environmental microbiologist at the University of Arizona. It's usually either from contaminated hands or somebody who was sick preparing your food. Hepatitis, a virus, causes hepatitis A, can live for several hours on human hands and up to several days on household surfaces. It's also persistent during freezing temperatures and staying infectious in water for up to a year. How it spreads? From person to person, usually when someone ingests contaminated food or water. It can also spread if you come into close personal contact with an infected individual, such as during intercourse. Typical scenario: you eat something that was prepared by a person who has hepatitis A or who wasn't using sanitary practices, such as washing hands after going to the restroom or touching other contaminated areas. Not so fun fact, symptoms can take between 15 and 50 days to appear after you contract the virus. Your kids may not show symptoms at all. Dung virus causes dung fever. Can live for... Dung virus spreads only through mosquito bites, so it doesn't survive on surfaces alone. How it spreads? Through the bite of a mosquito carrying one of the viruses. You can't get it from person-to-person contact. Typical scenario, you travel abroad in a tropical region populated with this particular mosquito, and you get bitten. It can take up to 5 days to show symptoms, and the fever can last for a week. Not so fun fact, once infected, you build immunity and won't be infected with that particular virus again. However, if there are four different dung viruses, and it's possible to contract all four in your lifetime. E. coli bacteria causes intestinal infection. Can live for up to a day in food, but it can't survive on hard surfaces or skin. How it spreads? Through food or water that's been contaminated from unsanitary practices or improper food handling, as well as through consuming foods that haven't been stored at the right temperature. Typical scenario, you make a ground beef burger, but like it on the rare side, so you don't cook it to an internal temperature of 160 degrees Fahrenheit. In a hurry, you throw on some raw lettuce and tomato that you didn't wash properly. Feta is your favorite cheese, but you didn't check to see if it was made with pasteurized milk. Not so fun fact, you're more likely to come into contact with E. coli during the summer, June to September, and symptoms of intestinal infection can take up to 10 days to appear. And the last one in this list is Listeria bacteria. It causes invasive listeriosis. It can live for up to 20 to 30 days on hard surfaces. It can grow when stored above 40 degrees Fahrenheit. How it spreads? Eating food contaminated with the germ or not cleaning surfaces that the bacteria has come into contact with. Typical scenario, you drink unpasteurized milk or eat soft cheese made with unpasteurized milk. You consume raw or undercooked hot dogs and deli meats or refrigerated smoked seafood. Outbreaks have also been linked to produce such as raw sprouts, room temperature cantaloupe, and celery. Not so fun fact, sprouts grow in warmth and humidity. So do bacteria. Washing sprouts will not remove bacteria, so be sure to cook them fully. Now we have here 8 ways to avoid germs, but I think I'm going to save that for next time, and let's go on to another article. This next article is from the Essential Retirement Guide, Controlling Household Costs in Retirement. These tips can help you lower your expenses. For most people, retiring means a shift to living on a fixed income, one that may be less than you made during your working years. One way to cut down on your living expenses is to reduce your household costs. The Bureau of Labor Statistics found that housing costs, which include mortgages, property taxes, insurance, and maintenance account for 34% of annual spending for retirees aged 65 and older. That's a pretty big bite out of your savings and Social Security each month. If you can manage and, where it's possible, minimize those costs, you'll be closer to a comfortable retirement, and you'll have more money to spend on activities you love. Here are a number of strategies you can use to control your housing costs in retirement. Pay off your mortgage, if you haven't already. If you're retired and still making payments on your home, you're not alone. A third of homeowners between the ages of 65 and 74 are carrying a balance on their mortgage with an average of $118,000, according to the Federal Reserve. For some people, paying off a mortgage early makes financial sense. For others, sticking with regular monthly payments, even into retirement, is the wisest choice. Paying off your mortgage means eliminating what is likely your largest monthly bill. If you think you might struggle to afford your mortgage payments on a fixed monthly income, it might make sense to pay off your mortgage using some of your savings. You'll then own your home free and clear, ensuring that whatever else happens, you won't need to worry about housing costs. However, if paying off your mortgage early would seriously deplete your savings or cost you a lot in taxes and early withdrawal penalties, doing so might not be the smartest option. If you want to speed up the process of paying off your mortgage but can't manage to do it in one fell swoop, consider making additional payments on your principal or refinancing to shorten your loan's term. Going into retirement with a mortgage may make you uneasy, but it's not necessarily something to lose sleep over. As long as you continue to make payments, you're building equity in your home, and you can still deduct mortgage interest on up to $750,000 of mortgage debt when you file your taxes. Talking to a financial professional can help you determine whether using savings to pay off a mortgage is a good idea for you. Here's a pro tip. Speed up the process of paying off your mortgage by making additional payments on your principal. If you're an empty nester with more room than you need, downsizing may be the answer. A smaller home can reduce the cost of utilities like heating and electric bills, as well as property taxes. And with less home to maintain, you can potentially avoid some of the costly and time-consuming upkeep that comes with larger homes. If your home is already paid off, the proceeds from its sale might be enough to cover the purchase of a smaller property and even leave you with money left over. If your home is only partially paid off, proceeds from the sale could still potentially pay off your outstanding mortgage debt and leave you with money to put toward a new, smaller home. But when it comes to going small, it's important to remember that size isn't always everything. Location is just as important a factor in reducing expenses through a move. Consider how you want to spend your retirement. Do you want to live close to family, or do you plan to spend much of your time traveling? Housing costs vary considerably from one neighborhood, state, and region to the next. For example, a one-bedroom condo in the city where your children live could have higher property taxes, homeowners insurance, and utilities than your three-bedroom house in the suburbs. You may save a considerable amount by living somewhere that provides discounted public transportation and other services for seniors. Make sure to weigh all the factors and consider how location will affect your move. That way you can ensure that going small will actually mean big savings. Become a landlord or a roommate. To pare down your housing costs, you might consider turning your home into a source of income by renting out a room or section of your living area. Leasing space in your house can help cover your monthly mortgage payment or property taxes. If your home is already paid off, renting a room can help cover maintenance or even provide some extra income. If you have a spare bedroom, look into offering short-term rentals through a platform like Airbnb. Short-term rentals can be a lucrative option if you live in a popular tourist destination. But before you post a listing, do your due diligence. Check with your city to confirm that your rental complies with local regulations, and be sure you're clear on the fees and the work involved in sharing your home. And ensure it's allowed under your area's pandemic reopening guidelines. Homeowners with a separate living space within their residence might consider renting it to long-term residents. While becoming a landlord requires more logistical oversight than home sharing, it also provides you with a more stable income. Looking to downsize? Consider buying a property with multiple units where you can live in one and rent out the others. This kind of arrangement can pay big dividends over time, but remember, you'll also need to pay taxes on the money you make renting space. A thoughtful approach to managing housing costs can be the foundation for an effective retirement plan. Your housing needs may change as you age, but by making smart choices early on, you can set yourself up for a flexible future. Now, here's an article from your AARP magazine. Offering a friendly voice, volunteers give hope and help to the socially isolated. For many whose social isolation has been deepened by the COVID-19 pandemic, little is more nourishing than sharing time with someone warm and trustworthy on the other end of a phone. AARP's Friendly Voice program was set up to break through the wall of loneliness made more formidable by social distancing. Volunteers recruited from across the country agree to call those who have signed up to hear from someone. Those seeking a call reach out to AARP's program through this link, aarp.org/friendly voice. The call requests go on a roster that the volunteers use when making their calls. Those reached who are having a crisis are steered to appropriate help. The volunteers. Barbara Welcher, 69, of Augusta, Georgia, has big plans for this year. Had big plans. Her first after retirement. She was going to take her first train ride, tour America from New York to California, and make a stop at South Carolina beaches. COVID-19 changed those plans, she said. So she has signed up to help with this program. It has 275 volunteers that are trained to make these calls. 4,100 people have signed up to receive friendly calls, and volunteers have engaged in over 5,000 conversations to date. Well, folks, we have run out of time for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.